This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare.
Where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey.
Serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England.
Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at DOUCETSurvey.com. That's DoucetSurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Election 2016 is on. Yep. New Hampshire's first in the nation primary may be a year away, but behind the scenes, potential presidential candidates are jockeying for position. Late last week, Mitt Romney told donors he's, quote, seriously considering, unquote, another run, while Republican Congressman Paul Ryan told NBC News he will not pursue a presidential run in 2016. Then there is Jeb Bush, who has yet to make an official announcement, but has said he's going to, quote, actively explore the possibility of running. While paying attention to maneuvering at this stage in the political race may seem like a recipe for early onset election fatigue, political scientist Seth Maskett argues that this is the most exciting part of the campaign and makes that case in an article for Pacific Standard magazine. Seth is author of No Middle Ground, How Informal Party Organizations Control Nominations and Polarize Legislatures. Seth, great to have you on Word of Mouth.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
So really, I mean, we get enough of this election stuff. Why do we pay attention now?
Well, this is probably pretty rough if you live in a place like New Hampshire,
right,
where the candidates descend pretty early. This, to me, is the most exciting and interesting part because this is where most of the key decisions are being made. Right now, you have at least a dozen, maybe more, potential candidates for president, at least on the Republican side. And this is also the time when a lot of party insiders, that is some key donors, some media figures, some major party activists, are all having a conversation of sorts about just which sort of candidates they like and which ones they don't like. And this is where we really narrow down the field. So right now you have, we're in a stage called traditionally the invisible primary.
What does that mean? No one's officially announced?
So an invisible primary is really what's going on there is that a lot of decisions are being made, selections are being made, candidates are being kind of kicked out of the race without any actual voting occurring. So voters aren't really getting a chance to weigh in yet. That won't happen for another year. So this decision on who to nominate is really kind of being made for the rest of us.
You've introduced this idea of the invisible primary. I mean, how do we even know it's going on, and where is it going on? Who's having these conversations?
Well, when you see candidates showing up in early primary and caucus states like New Hampshire or Iowa or South Carolina and giving not necessarily big speeches, but meeting with small groups of activists and some major donors, that's part of the conversation right there. You also see it in sort of the smaller, more ideological press coverage of what these candidates are like. When you see opinion makers in op-ed sections of newspapers or on TV talking about, you know, evaluating Jeb Bush's ideological predispositions and trying to decide, is he really where the rest of the Republican Party is right now? Is he the sort of person who could actually win for us? Would he do, would he move the party in the direction we want it to go? That's part of the conversation.
So these party elites, these kind of, these small groups of supporters, how important are they? Has anyone in recent memory been able to run without that kind of support?
No. What you often see is the party, these party elites, these party insiders, kind of coalescing around one candidate. And fairly often there are, you know, some other candidates who are still interested in running but just can't get their act together. So, I mean, a great example would be in the Republican nomination in the year 2000, when a lot of Republican insiders just had very clearly backed George W. Bush very early on. I mean, basically every sitting Republican governor had endorsed him early in, basically in 1999. And a lot of other Republican candidates that year just realized, oh, well, look, everyone seems to be backing W, and so this is just not the year for me to run.
Mm-hmm.
John McCain had different ideas and thought, well, if I can, you know, I can still appeal to your basic Republican voters who turn up in primaries. And he ran a very strong campaign and wooed a lot of media and got a lot of attention. Nonetheless, he still couldn't get the delegates. He couldn't get the actual primary organization and primary votes together in a way that he needed, and he ultimately had to withdraw. He played much more of an insider game in 2008, and the party was willing to coalesce behind him for that. So you see this pattern in quite a few nomination cycles where the party has clearly backed someone. There's usually some sort of media darling who emerges to try and contest that, and they usually do not succeed.
Well, Seth, is it possible to even pay attention to what is happening now if all of this is going on in back rooms and private donor functions?
Well, it's possible. It's just a lot trickier to figure it out. Some of this stuff is occurring in a very secretive way, and some of it just doesn't seem very well organized. The key is to kind of focus on some of the activists in these early states and to talk with some of the major donors and to see what the conversations are like among current governors and senators and House members when they try to decide who they're going to endorse. You know, that's kind of the interesting part. And when you see the pattern that those endorsements are going in, that actually helps us figure out where the party is leaning. But a lot of those endorsements just haven't been made yet.
What do you recommend for those of us who are not party elites but would like to pay attention to the race? Are there particular Twitter feeds? Are there particular candidates we should be looking at in a new way?
You know, this is a time when you actually it's helpful to pay attention to very partisan media outlets. So to follow like either Fox News or conservative blogs and see what kind of discussion they're having about the different Republican candidates, to see how they're talking about different candidates. Would they be deemed acceptable or not? And what would it take for them to raise some sort of an actual campaign? It's also helpful to just follow local press in some areas and places in New Hampshire, in Iowa, and just see how the candidates are being reported there. And also, again, for covering the Republican nomination cycle, to watch the coverage of conservative events like CPAC, the Conservative Political mm-hmm. Action Committee, when they have their meetings and invite candidates out, to first see who gets invitations, to see how audiences respond to different candidates. That doesn't necessarily determine what will ultimately happen, but it can give us some kind of an indication of how influential party insiders are feeling about these different candidates.
Seth, when can we expect the field to be narrowed for this invisible primary to become visible?
You will start to see that toward the end of this calendar year. I would assume that by November, December, maybe earlier, the Republican Party will start having some of its debates among the presidential candidates. Those can end up being somewhat influential. I mean, that certainly didn't do much to help Rick Perry's attempts last time around, might hurt him this year, or might help. That's the time when it becomes a much more visible process, and you can see the sort of things that can actually hurt a candidate. I would say one thing not to pay too close attention to right now would be public opinion polls. Not that they're wrong, they're just they can be very misleading at this point. If a candidate, you know, I wouldn't be surprised to see a poll showing that Mitt Romney is doing very well in public opinion polls among Republican primary voters. That doesn't necessarily mean he's going to win. That simply means he's one of the best known among them because he was the most recent presidential nominee. The public in many ways are kind of the last ones to weigh in on this, not the first.
Seth Maskett, thank you for drawing back the curtain on the invisible primary.
Certainly. Thanks for having me.
Seth Maskett is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Denver, and you'll find a link to read his article for Pacific Standard on the invisible primary at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. So other parts of the country may be in the dark in this early stage of the election game, but New Hampshire residents are keenly aware that the invisible primary is in full swing. And somebody who keeps a really close eye on this simmering stew of candidates here in New Hampshire is NHPR senior political reporter Josh Rogers. Political recently named Josh's Twitter feed an early state must follow. Hello, Josh.
Hey, Virginia.
So we're in New Hampshire in an age when people talk about national politics sort of taking over. Do local politics still have a place in this invisible primary?
New Hampshire's a place where candidates come to demonstrate that they can interact with voters in a sort of semi-legitimate manner, unmediated, and, you know, get over with them. A lot of money isn't raised by candidates in New Hampshire, but New Hampshire is a place where candidates can build some sort of credibility that they can go into a room, people are going to pay attention to what they say, and people are going to potentially leave the room excited to go do the work that it takes to win a campaign.
Yeah, so they build credibility, but how about their support system? How do they sort of get their ground game going in New Hampshire? What are the mechanics of that?
Showing up, acting like you're interested in local people, local goings-on. Some candidates send Christmas cards are a traditional way to know if somebody's potentially looking at a run. If you're an activist, Republican or Democrat, and you start getting a lot of Christmas cards from people who are thinking about running, they also send them to reporters. Showing up, writing small checks for small races, just mainly being familiar by showing up a lot. You have somebody, Rand Paul's here this week. I think this is his sixth visit in the last few months. A lot of it is just, you know, basic getting to know you kind of stuff.
Who's he meeting with when Rand Paul comes to town?
Well, his trip this time, he met with conservative lawmakers. He was meeting with some, a shooting sports place to meet with gun rights activists. He was going to attend a meeting at a charter school where there are going to be people talking about the Common Core. Some of it is kind of checking the box of ideological groups. On the Democratic side, you might come and you might meet with union folks. You might go to some sort of abortion rights event. A lot of it is just like hitting activist segments within either party, looking them in the eye, and when you look them in the eye, hopefully showing some glimmer of recognition that, oh, I've been here before and I know that you're, allegedly consequential. Mm-hmm. But it's just sort of winning votes one by one. Obviously, there's the whole money side of it is a different thing. But New Hampshire's a place where there are some vestigial elements of real retail campaigning where a candidate can make ground.
So that's big groups. Are there any sort of kingmakers, any people you must meet in New Hampshire that open up the state either financially or politically?
Well, there are probably dozens of people, on either side of the aisle who wake up, look themselves in the mirror and say, oh, well, I'm consequential and candidates must get to know me. But there certainly are people who their resumes would suggest due to volunteering early on campaigns that have worked here, due to their knowledge of the local political scene, are certainly helpful people to help you navigate and people who with a big Rolodex who can introduce you around and have political networks.
It doesn't always make a winning candidate, however. Can you think of a candidate who's kind of come through and sort of done the local support successfully, gotten local support, but hasn't particularly done well?
It's a short list. I mean, people say, oh, maybe three candidates can make it out of New Hampshire. Dozens may show up. I mean, there's certainly candidates who have come in here and clearly demonstrated that they weren't plausible presidential candidates. You think back to 2008, Fred Thompson, when, there was seen as an opportunity for a conservative candidate to come in, well into this race. And, Fred Thompson arrived. He had an event at the Doug Scammon's farm where Mitt Romney launched his campaign, venue for a lot of big Bush events. He got off his bus and it was immediately apparent to the people that were there that this guy wasn't going to go anywhere. And he, barely came back to New Hampshire.
So what do local politicians and lobbyists get out of this invisible primary? Is there some maneuvering going on behind the scenes that you think is worth noting?
Well, I mean, certainly it depends on how many candidates are running, but there are lots of people who are very engaged in the political process. I hear a lot of people like to really be participants in campaigns. And, on the high side, local people, you can potentially end up as an ambassador if your person becomes president. That's happened. Mm-hmm. you can launch your own political career potentially. But, you know, for most of these people, what we're talking about is people who enjoy participating in politics. And there's some, you know, prestige or sort of social capital, cultural capital that comes out of proximity to people who are powerful. But so, you know, it's all over the map. I mean, but there's on some levels when, you know, you look at candidates who are truly popular in New Hampshire, you know, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, when they ran, you know, Mitt Romney the last time, there's, you know, there are only so many people who are going to be like kind of riding in the first car of the caravan. And, you know, for a lot of other activists, it's a pecking order, and you may not end up with the person you might most want to be with because you're not going to be, you know, invited into the sort of purported inner sanctum of the campaign. And so you may end up farther down the line. And certainly there are, to the extent, you know, candidates come here and, you know, activists are kicking the tires and also looking for potential opportunities participating, you know, up and down the food chain.
Well, should be exciting. Thank you so much, Josh, for joining us.
No problem, Virginia.
Josh Rogers is NHPR senior political reporter. And again, Politico recently named his Twitter feed an early state must follow. We couldn't agree more strongly.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. With the spring semester now underway, we continue The Uncommon Core, a new series that highlights offbeat courses offered at American colleges and universities. Last week, we found a class on invented languages. This week, a professor explains what students can learn about race and gender and American identity by studying one of the nation's most beloved and reviled competitions.
Hi, I'm Afia Ofori-Mensah, and I teach a course called How to Win a Beauty Pageant at Oberlin College in Oberlin, Ohio.
Oh, there she is, Miss Auburn.
I think the educational value of studying beauty pageants lies in the fact that people can connect to them in some kinds of ways, but at the same time, they're foreign. They happen every year. Thousands of them happen in the United States alone. They happen all over the world.
Our first runner-up to Miss Africa USA.
Contestant number 24, Yoshiki Sindal.
How do you feel?
Salamat sa mga kababayan ko.
But they're also unusual. In some ways, it's like a subculture. It's not something that everybody does. But I have found almost always somebody says, oh, my cousin was in one, or my sister used to do those, or I used to do them.
When I'm not at work in elderly care, I love to volunteer at my local cat shelter as I have an obsession with cats. An interesting fact about me is I am the first Miss Gibraltar of Moroccan descent, which just goes to show what a beautiful, cultural, diverse country Gibraltar is.
When you talk about the titles of beauty pageants, like Miss America or something like that, there's a suggestion written into the title that this person is supposed to be a representative of a whole national group of people. And so if that's the case, we should be able to watch how that person changes over time, which is to say, who are the different winners year after year after year. And that can tell us something about how the nation, too, is changing over time, and tell us also something about ideals of femininity and how ideals of femininity tie into ideals of nationhood.
Women's roles in the U.S. have changed dramatically since the 1960s. What changes would you like to see next?
Well, I'd like to see changes as far as women also, well, like President Clinton is doing, he's getting a lot of women in the House of Representatives. I think that also,
relax. Take a second.
That first time that I taught it at the University of Michigan, there was this mid-semester evaluation process that we did there. And one piece of feedback said, I felt like the title was misleading. And that seemed to suggest to me that someone had actually taken the class hoping that they would learn the steps and tools for how to win a beauty pageant, which was shocking to me because it was a 300-level American culture seminar.
Mallory, you have been a phenomenal Miss America. Are you ready to pass on the crown?
I am. It's time.
We do readings by scholars who have actually written specifically about beauty pageants. So Miss America, Japanese-American Nisei Week Queen pageants, Miss Fine Brown Frame in African-American communities in the 1940s. And so we do readings about those throughout the semester, coupled with theoretical readings that teach students about things like intersectionality, performativity and how gender is constructed and all these kinds of things. In addition to that, there's one capstone assignment centered on a field visit to the Miss Gay America drag pageant, female impersonation pageant.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the 34th annual Miss Gay America pageant.
A lot of things that I say, like on the first day when we're reading the syllabus and that kind of stuff, suggest that this class is not going to be an easy class. Word gets around very quickly that I'm not an easy professor to take a class from. To some extent, I don't even have to do that work anymore. The reputation does it for me.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. From the old lady who only drove her car to church on Sundays, to Juan Valdez sniffing coffee beans, to the stockbroker turned artisanal pickle maker, story sells. Whether real or invented, the narrative of a product or a brand, its source, its history, creates a sense of authenticity that some consumers crave in a market dominated by cheap consumer goods and big box stores. Science writer Matthew Hudson wrote about how some brands are quenching that thirst for authenticity in an article for the New York Times. And Matthew Hudson, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
Authenticity is one of those nebulous ideas that people argue about. How does a brand establish authenticity?
Well, one way is by telling an origin story. So if you tell this tale about the founders struggling to create some new product and, you know, these challenges they had to overcome and how they put their heart and soul into the product, then when people see the product, they think of the founders and they think of these human qualities that have somehow become a part of the product and a part of the brand.
There's also often a sort of sense of place. You know, it's really important that Hershey chocolate come from Hershey, Pennsylvania. What's behind that?
So it turns out that sometimes we treat authenticity as something that can literally rub off on a product. So if there's a story or history to a particular factory, for instance, then the products that come out of that factory, we'll see them as having authenticity just by coming into contact with the factory, as being a part of that history, literally.
You give a really good, interesting example of that in the Levi Strauss plant. The factory of origin actually made a difference.
Yeah, so there was a study in which subjects were asked to consider a pair of jeans made in a Levi factory constructed in 1906 or in a newer factory. And they were asked which one they would prefer. And they said that the jeans made in the older factory felt more authentic and they would pay more for those jeans. So somehow we think that authenticity is contagious and that products that come out of old or original factories can somehow pick up on these qualities. So this magical aura, whatever you want to call it, it gets transmitted down the line. So from factory to product to us, and somehow we probably feel more authentic.
There are a number of examples of companies who are working at this in your article. One of them is an online site. It's called Zadie. It's an emerging brand working really hard to establish authenticity, you know, well-made craftsmanship. Here's just the sound of a very, I'd say, mannered video showing the process of getting wool from pasture to loom to make one of Zadie's signature sweaters. Okay, so Matthew, if we were to be really authentic, this is what sheep shearing sounds like. This was recorded at a farm in Derbyshire, England. This feels to me a little bit like manipulation. Is that too strong a word?
Well, every story involves some amount of shaping and omission, so you're always going to put your best foot forward. And it's no surprise that companies that are trying to sell a product are going to shape their stories to put their product in the best light possible.
Well, and even and you mentioned the in the case of even some of the most well-established couture fashion houses in Paris, selling this whole idea of tradition, this is all a myth. They've made this up?
Well, in some cases. For instance, there's a company called Madewell that originated early in the 20th century, and now it's a subsidiary of J. Crew, and they've kept the logo and the trademark Madewell, even though they now manufacture the clothes overseas. So there's really no tangible connection to the original company, to the original history. They're basically just using the name and trading off of that.
Matthew Hudson is with us. He wrote an article for the New York Times about consumers' quest for authenticity in their products, the origins of things, all the steps through the supply chain, even if sometimes that story is just made up. You brought up an interesting point. Maybe a part of this is responsibility. I mean, we want to believe, we want to think that the products that we are consuming are made responsibly. How much of this has to do with the idea that so much is farmed out and produced in factories overseas?
So it's possible that a lot of this, there's sort of a trend toward marketing things as artisanal or authentic or original. And it's possible that it comes from a consumer demand. So a lot of our products now come from China. They're shipped in containers. We buy them at Walmart. So there's sort of this homogeneity in our the things that we buy. So it's possible that we're searching for something that we're missing. And that's why we're looking for these products. It's also possible that this phenomenon is completely manufactured by marketers. Suddenly they're telling us that we want artisanal and authentic, and that's why we're now searching for it.
The irony here is that this could mean that the mom-and-pop brands, the little tiny fledgling stores, would be edged out by bigger companies claiming to be authentic or traditional.
Yes, that's very true. There is a story of Tito's handmade vodka, and they still call themselves handmade, but there's actually a lawsuit against them currently saying that they're no longer handmade. They've ratcheted up their production, so they're producing hundreds of thousands of crates a year, and it's hard to believe that they are still the little guy. And so it's possible that actual little guys are no longer selling to people who are now buying Tito's.
Matthew, what does it take to pass the sniff test on authenticity? If we're talking about brands that are, you know, sometimes with marketing firms, sometimes with using myth, they're creating this sense of authenticity. What's our role as consumers to either buy or not to buy?
Well, your responsibility is up to you, depending on what your priorities are, whether you care about how something was made. But if you want to, buy only products made a certain way, then it's your responsibility to do a bit of digging. Unfortunately, there is a lot of information out there, especially online. So if you want to dig, you can dig and you can find the backstory and find the origins, but not totally. A lot of that stuff is still not out there.
Matthew Hudson, thank you very much for filling us in.
Thanks for having me.
Matthew Hudson is a freelance science writer. He wrote an article for the New York Times called Quenching Consumers' Thirst for Authentic Brands. Really interesting. You can find a link to read it for yourself at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Levi's 501 jeans have stayed in style for 150 years. Don't know why they're the only jeans you can wear that say, I'm not trying to be noticed, but I won't be ignored.
When it comes to the rugged, authentic American male ideal, who can beat the lumberjack? Up next, the signposts of a growing fashion trend that New Hampshire men could really cash in on. The lumber sexual. We'll get some guidance on identifying the real deal when Word of Mouth returns after a short break.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. New Hampshire is not known for following fashion trends, especially its men, who are, in general, a practical bunch. more likely to be layered up than found in skinny jeans or slim-fitting jackets, or even talking to those who would be silly enough to wear them. Imagine our surprise when the relatively common New Hampshire male uniform of plaid flannel shirts, untrimmed beards, watch caps, and weathered work boots became de rigueur for urban males. Late last year, the website Gear Junkie coined the term lumbersexual to describe the men who have adopted the rural New England look, and the flannel has been flying off the racks ever since. Joining us to discuss the finer points of this is Jack Savage, who works for the Society for the Protection of New Hampshire Forests. He's also executive editor of the quarterly magazine Forest Notes, who created quite a stir when he wrote an article helping to distinguish the real lumberjack from the poser. And Jack, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much, Virginia.
Great to have you with us. Can you describe for our listeners what epitomizes the lumber sexual look?
Well, I think it's, at first appearance, it's a flannel shirt, maybe buffalo plaid, bushy beard. It's sort of Mike Napoli circa 2013, right? You know, the Red Sox. And denim. There's got to be denim there someplace. Probably some work boots. They're probably pretty clean work boots, though. And this is the tricky part. And this is where, you know, we tried to provide a public service to the women in New Hampshire to distinguish between what apparently is a poser, the lumbersexual poser, who can't actually do things like start a fire in the woods or build a piece of furniture or something like that, and the real New Hampshire man, who, of course, is always extremely handy and good for getting things done.
Okay, so your article actually offers 12 tips to help women distinguish the
right
poser from the...
And I should say that I got these tips from women themselves. I walked around the building over at the Forest Society and... you know, they know the difference.
So a real scientific sampling.
Yeah, to figure out. This wasn't just me trying to figure this out.
Okay, so let's focus on maybe the most defining characteristic, the beard. What distinguishes the lumbersexual beard from that grown in New Hampshire?
Well, before I looked into this, I didn't even know that beard oil existed. And so I don't think a real New Hampshire man would ever have beard oil unless it was splatter from the chainsaw. Right? So there's bar oil for the real New Hampshire man and beard oil for the lumbersexual.
They also cultivate this style, I guess, the lumbersexual does, to attract women.
That's right. And I think that's one of the core things. You got to look at the motivation. So the lumbersexual, he's putting on a style in order to attract good-looking women. And for the real New Hampshire man, we know it's cold all winter long. We need a woman who doesn't just look good, but actually has all the same skills as a real New Hampshire man. And that's one of the differences between the real New Hampshire man and the real New Hampshire woman. The real New Hampshire man has all these skills and puts them to use on occasion. The real New Hampshire woman can do all of those things, but they're clever enough to get a real New Hampshire man to do it.
How about the scent? You write about the lumbersexual smells like vintage pine. Well, first of all, what is vintage pine?
Well, you know,
smell
I don't
like?
Know. I got. I think it was Cosmo that said that a lumbersexual smells like 1950s pine. Well, I'm not quite sure what that smells like.
And the authentic New Hampshire man, what does he smell?
Well,
like?
He's going to smell more like a little bit of off-road diesel and maybe combusted two-stroke oil, you know, from either the chainsaw, maybe the snowblower, or maybe the snowmobile, something like that, little aura circulating around him. And as I pointed out, that if you're a woman and you like that smell, you're probably from Maine.
Now we get to the actual physical aspect of the look. The lumbersexual actually enjoys splitting wood, according to your highly scientific distinction. Is this likely because he's chopping a few logs for, you know, an Instagram photo shoot or something?
Yeah, exactly right. You've got it. So it's the 30 minutes of polishing the axe and then going out and splitting a few pieces of wood. And the real New Hampshire man understands that the goal here is not to look good but to keep the house warm, and is out there trying to fiddle around with a hydraulic wood splitter, preferably borrowed but from the neighbor.
you don't want to buy your own.
Are you kidding me? That's one of the key things about a real New Hampshire man. It's all about saving money and doing things the cheapest way possible.
Well, the rise of the lumbersexual, what do you think it's about?
First of all, I think that it was clear to the wannabe lumbersexuals that the real New Hampshire men were getting all the good women. Mm-hmm. And so they wanted to imitate it. Other social commentators have suggested that it's this desire to go back to sort of a neo-environmentalism kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, you work for the Society of Protection of New Hampshire Forests.
Yeah, but we're
what
sort
do you
of,
think?
We've been around since 1901, so we're not neo. We're the real deal.
Well, I understand that, you know, that kind of idea that people have to know how to make things and produce things and be useful. There is a real sort of craving for that. Do you think it's enough just to buy the flannel shirt?
Well, it depends on what your goals are. Some women report to me that lumbersexuals will promise to do something, but months and months and go by, and it turns out that they can't do it. Now, that's no different than a real New Hampshire man. A real New Hampshire man might say, oh, don't worry, I can take that care of that for you, and you're still going to have to wait months and months and months. But the fact is that he could do it if he put his mind to it.
Well, you've been talking about New Hampshire women. What have they said in response to this article?
Well, they have, you know, anytime people respond as much as they have to this thing, you realize that you've tapped into something true. It's not just funny. There's some truth behind it. And so I've been hearing from many women around the state who think that I have kind of nailed what it is to be a lumbersexual versus a real New Hampshire man. Mm-hmm. It's also prompted them to ask the question, you know, if this is a real New Hampshire man, what makes a real New Hampshire woman? Now, this is a very dangerous question for me to try to answer. But I
agreed.
I will say this, that there are two kinds of real New Hampshire women. There's the inexperienced and the experienced. The inexperienced New Hampshire woman is attracted to a real New Hampshire man and understands that there are rough edges, but you get a lot in return. And they think that you can shape those rough edges over time to be more of a combination, right? Something that is more of the whole deal. Whereas the experienced New Hampshire woman has completely given up on the idea that you can smooth out the rough edges, with the one exception, they have negotiated for a regular change of underwear.
So there's progress. Well, it seems there may be a good opportunity here for locals, right, to maybe sell off their vintage flannel or their old worn Carhartt jackets and patched up dungarees.
Well, you got to stop right there. What's worn flannel? First of all, it's really only a difference between its use. If it's completely falling apart, it's then the rag you use to check your oil. Right?
So
there's really nothing, no such thing as a worn flannel shirt when it comes to a real New Hampshire man.
Well, Jack, this has been an education for me, I have to say. Have you seen any of these kind of city lumber sexuals up here in the wilds of New Hampshire?
Oh, yeah,
Forest?
You might see them hanging around Portsmouth a little bit, you know, maybe down in Newburyport, certainly crawling all over Boston. Go down there, you'll see them. And then they pop up into the state every once in a while. But if you pay close attention, as I said, you know, give a sniff and see whether it's vintage pine or a little diesel, and you'll know what you've got.
Jack Savage, he works for the Society for the Protection of New Hampshire Forests. He's also executive editor of the quarterly magazine Forest Notes. And he wrote an article which has caused quite a stir. It's called The Fine Art of Distinguishing New Hampshire's Real Men. Take the test for yourself at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Jack Savage, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
I'm a lumberjack and I'm okay. I sleep all night and I work all day.
He's a lumberjack and he's okay. He sleeps all night and he works all day.
I cut down trees, I eat my lunch, I go to the lavatory.
Looking like a lumbersexual may be a fashion trend for men, which led us to wonder, is there room for women in the actual lumberjack trade? The reporter Shara Morris traveled to the woods of Maine to find out.
It's 8 a.m., and instead of my usual Special K with almond milk, I'm eating eggs, potatoes, and pancakes with some old-timers in the American Legion Hall. George Kimball and Ed Roach are retirees of the New Page Rumford paper mill. I tell them about my quest to make it in rural Maine life and become a Lumber Jill, or Lumber Jane. First stop, the Paul Bunyan lookalike contest.
I know, I was thinking about doing a lookalike contest. How do you think I would fare?
Probably a zero.
Ouch. I was already wearing a flannel shirt and jeans,
But maybe I needed a bit of a makeover. So I sought help from the pro, real-life logger Kyle Dolliff.
I'm Paul Bunyan Jr., I guess.
He and his father own the Dolliff Logging Company in town. I spotted Kyle in the Lumberjack Festival parade and knew we had to talk. He is the embodiment of Paul Bunyan. He was just the guy to transform me from urbanite to country chic. Who are you wearing?
I'm not sure.
Tell me where you got your flannel from.
I'm not sure. I've had it quite a while now.
It sounds very vintage.
Oh, it is. Yeah, definitely.
Would you wear this normally?
Not suspenders. Not my style.
He ended up winning the Paul Bunyan lookalike contest. Daniel, Kyle's father, actually needs to wear his suspenders. He's like an old oak tree, a thick trunk with scars from chainsaws carved into his muscular arms. He is a man who has lived the lumberjack life. So I asked him for some advice. What does it take to be a good lumberjack?
Some of the stuff that they're doing today is just from past history, so it's not really what we do in the woods anymore, but it's the history of it.
Is it kind of a nostalgia or something?
Right. They used to cut trees with axes and buck saws and crosscut saws. Now, well, then it evolved into chainsaws. Now, as you can see around here, a lot of the machinery, it's guys set in the machinery and cut the trees and they don't even get on the ground.
That got me thinking. While I was on my search to make it in the rustic life, the lumberjacks were too. They feel the need to return to a time when they used their hands to cut wood instead of the chainsaw, use an axe instead of a skidder. We all want to relive this foregone lumberjack life, whether we're already surrounded by trees or need to take the subway to get there. But now, it was time to test my skills with the crosscut saw competition. You know those huge saws with the handles on both ends? Two people per team have to cut a piece of wood. Problem was, I didn't have a partner, and the competition was about to begin. I searched for someone spirited and strong in the crowd, and eyed a man with a fake beard. My teammate was Man About Town Carlos Puya. Carlos and I are ready for our challenge. But first, I needed to meet our opposition. These are two men who are, how tall are you?
I'm Enoch Turner. I'm 6'2".
My name's Virgil Bliss, standing in at an even 2 meters, 6'8".
And I'm 5'3". I'm trying to be a lumberjane. Do you think I can do it?
I don't think there's any place in the world for a lumberjane, but that's just me speaking.
What? No place for a lumberjane? These guys were like the jocks from an 80s movie. Life looked easy for them. And as the only girl who entered the competition, it felt like they had just raised the stakes. But enough for my towering rivals. It was time to saw.
Okay, I'm going to say go, and you start when I say go. Go!
You guys can get. You guys got this. Maybe.
Well, I must report, Carlos and I did not win the competition. So how'd you feel about that?
You did fine. That was great.
For crosscut sawing for the first time, I'll take fine. I came, I sawed, I didn't conquer, but my IKEA furniture is arriving tomorrow. Self-assembly required? I think I got this one. For Salt Radio, I'm Shara Morris.
Thanks so much for spending some time with us today. And there's much more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also get the Word of Mouth podcasts on iTunes. Earlier in the show, we spoke to a political scientist who made the case for paying attention to the presidential primary race even this early in the game. Okay, we'd like to know what you think. Are you paying attention to the candidates descending on New Hampshire? Or are you already projecting election fatigue? Does the presidential race start too early as it is? Well, you can join the conversation happening right now on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.